At the last page, page 43, which is the last page of last week's handout, is where we're going to pick up. But before I start on page 43, I want to just review briefly a little bit of where we kind of left off last time. We were talking about transmission and how the text... Well, what's transmission? Can anybody tell me what transmission is? See if I did my job as a teacher. Can anybody tell me, in real brief, what is transmission? What do we refer to when we refer to the transmission of the text? Correct. Really, copies. It's the way we got from the original down to the, you know, the critical text that we have today. It's the way in which the text was copied over the centuries down to what we have now. It's the transmission of the text. And how that we looked at how they compare texts and so forth, and what's involved in textual criticism. And what I'm dealing with now is primarily the New Testament, because when it comes to the text, really the question is mostly in regard to the New Testament. Most of the debates and most of the discussion, especially when you come to the versions, has to do with the New Testament. The Old Testament is pretty much, there aren't really too many things to worry about in the Old Testament in terms of the textual criticism. But I would reiterate again as I go through this, that I'm not an expert on these matters. This is not my area of expertise. It's something I've read a few books about over the years. And of course, you know, I went to seminary, so we learned all these things. But I'm not an expert on these things. So what I say with a certain amount of, I know there's a lot more that I don't know. Let's put it that way. But I, again, emphasize, in general, the text is very certain. Where there are issues, we know where those issues are. In other words, it's not a matter of when you open your Bible, it's like the whole text is in question. There are specific places and points where there are questions about the text. There was one in my sermon this morning, the question of whether it was the peace of Christ or the peace of God. That was a textual issue. And there is good evidence for both sides of that issue. Does that change our theology? No, I mean, we know where there are questions, where there are variants that are issues. And by and large, we're talking about 99% of the text is pure without question. There really aren't questions. Having said that, the issues in the New Testament, and this is the diagram I drew for you last time, if this is a timeline, and here's the 90 AD approximately, where John finished the Gospel of John, or the Apocalypse. And here's today, this is 1500, this is the Reformation, roughly, and 100. If you roughly drew a line around the 7th or 8th century, just kind of arbitrary, the vast majority of manuscripts in regard to the New Testament are here. Okay? They're between the 8th century and the 5th. I mean, roughly 95% of the manuscripts are here. The other 5%, roughly, of the 5,366 manuscripts are in here. And the most famous ones, which are the Codex Sinaiticus, Vaticanus, and Alexandrius, are roughly in the 4th century. Talking about 300-400 AD. Most of the manuscripts fall here. The 5% fall here. The question in textual criticism is, these are called the majority. Again, this is kind of a generic. I realize I'm being simplistic, but generally speaking, these follow what is called the majority text. They reflect the majority text, is what it's referred to. And it simply is the reflection of the majority of manuscripts, which is generally the foundation of the King James, just roughly. The question is, should we, as textual critics, follow the older texts, even though they're only 5% of the text? The Alexandrian text is what it's generally called. Again, I'm simplifying. Or the majority text, even though it's younger. It's not as old. Now, there are two ways you can look at it, okay? And the one person looks at this and says, and this is generally the view of scholarship today, generally speaking, this is where most people are. The closer you get to the original, that's the best. And that's really the main, so that you look at the Sinaiticus and the Vaticanus, those are the closest to the original. Those are the ones you're going to take, unless there's a reason not to. You're going to follow the Alexandrian text, that early text, even though it differs oftentimes from the majority text. Now, what's the other way you could look at this? Which is what, there's a small minority that look at it this way. What's another way you could look at this? Chris, you're a lawyer. How would you look? What if you would argue for this majority text, how might you argue? Okay, right. In other words, another way to say that, maybe these guys were familiar with the Alexandrian text and they thought it was corrupt, so they didn't copy it. That's how the majority text advocates look at it. That these guys were familiar with this text type, this Alexandrian text type, but they didn't copy it because they had reason to believe that maybe it wasn't the best, that it was a corrupt text. And the question comes, why didn't they copy it? Why is, from here on, the text is fairly consistent. So the question is, why didn't they copy these older texts? That is not, by any means, the majority view. The majority view says the older the better, period. And then, unless there's a reason to move away from the Alexandrian text, they stick with that for the most part. Well, that's what I say. No matter which, as I said the last week, no matter which way you go, you're still roughly 99% pure. This is not a large amount of text. It does affect some issues. I'll say more about this whole thing as we go through page 43. But I wanted to bring you back to this idea, this thinking. Again, this is oversimplification. There's more than just the Alexandrian text versus the majority text. There are various families like the Caesarean and so forth. I don't want to get into all that. This is kind of simplified, but in general, that is the question. That's the tension. Now let me then, in lieu of that, or in view of that, talk about the historical development of textual criticism. And I know this is kind of historical, but it does help you in understanding the nature of what happened over the years in relation to the text and the translations. And it might be a little tedious, but I think it is worthwhile. If you look at the first three I have there are Erasmus, Stephanus, and Beza. All three of these men basically come out of the Reformation period. They're not all reformers, but they all come out of the Reformation period, and they all published Greek texts, Greek critical texts, using a small number of late manuscripts. In other words, they didn't have the Alexandrinus, they didn't have the Sinaiticus, they didn't have all these, they didn't even have many late manuscripts. This is based on a handful of late, like 10th century, 11th century manuscripts. Erasmus, who is probably most known to us as kind of in opposition to Luther, when Luther wrote his Bondage of the Will, it was in response to Erasmus's Freedom of the Will. And that's how he's probably most well known. But Erasmus was a great textual critic. And he published the very first Greek New Testament, the very first printed, using the printed press. Gutenberg invented the movable type in the mid-15th century. This was the first Greek text printed, and it was Erasmus. Stephanus and Beza both basically worked off of Erasmus's work. They were kind of like, it's not quite this simple, but they were basically revisions of Erasmus. They were slight changes, but they basically worked off of Erasmus. These three are all related. Beza, of course, is Calvin's successor at Geneva. These three men were scholars. They, you know, they understood the Greek and so forth. And they generally all came up with their own editions of the Greek New Testament with very slight variations. They are basically the same text with the same base, and they basically start with Erasmus. That base is what essentially has come to be known as the Textus Receptus, which means received text in Latin. If you want to sound intelligent, just take a name, turn it into Latin, and you sound intelligent. So instead of saying the received text, we say the Textus Receptus. But it was given that name, actually, after the King James was printed. It was given that name in 1633 by a printer who printed an edition of the Greek text that was basically the same text as these three men worked. I think it was based on Beza's text, as I recall. But these are basically, in fact, I have here a copy of the Textus Receptus. I do refer to it. This is the Textus Receptus. This is, according to the preface, which I was reading here this afternoon, the present edition of the Textus Receptus underlying the English authorized version of 1611 follows the text of Beza's 1598 edition as the primary authority. So this follows Beza's 1598 edition. That Textus Receptus, which is basically the work of Erasmus, Stephanus, and Beza, was the foundation for the King James. The King James was basically based on that text. It was actually a revision of another English translation, which we'll look at in a minute, but the Greek text underlying it has been called the Textus Receptus. Now what's unique about this is for centuries, really up until the 19th century, there was really not a lot of, except among scholars, there was very little question about the text. The Textus Receptus was just basically what was considered to be the text. And there really wasn't much discussion about it. In the 18th century, or 19th century, there was a movement among scholars, particularly in England, away from, and Germany, well, Europe, away from the Textus Receptus. And what happened was there was, over this period, there was this development of textual criticism, which is what I went over last week. You know, the theory of how we critique texts, how we look at texts, how we decide what the original reading was, you know, so forth and so on. Plus, there were a lot of texts discovered in the 19th century that they didn't have when the Textus Receptus was formed. So there were men like, and I list these men, Tischendorf, Tregelles, Henry Alford. You could list a number of names. These men, by and large, were not so much out-and-out liberals, but they were certainly not conservatives. These were men like Henry Alford, probably most well-known for a Greek edition of the New Testament, where it was a commentary with a translation. He's Church of England. He would probably not be evangelical in the sense that we are, although he wasn't out-and-out liberal. Tregelles and Tischendorf were both very important in the development of textual criticism as a science. And in fact, Tischendorf was the one who discovered Sinaiticus, Codex Sinaiticus, in St. Catherine's Monastery in Mount Sinai. So these men and others, J.B. Lightfoot you could include in there, guys who were great scholars, who kind of took in a lot of the, I should point out too, kind of took in more along the lines of the naturalistic thinking that was taking place in the universities. These men were moving away from the Textus Receptus very rapidly. I mean, they saw that the Textus Receptus was not a reflection of the earliest manuscripts. And so there was this gradual rise of cry among scholars in Europe in the 19th century of, we need a new translation. We need a new Greek text. The Textus Receptus is not the best text. And so the dam kind of broke with Westcott and Hort. And in fact, if you read any King James-only literature, which I've read a little bit of it, these guys are right down there with Satan, okay, Westcott and Hort. They are the true, they're painted in the worst colors, to say the least. Westcott and Hort were kind of along the lines of Lightfoot and Alford. They were guys who were, again, not out-and-out liberals, but they were certainly not really, you know, conservative evangelicals either, but they were scholars, and they basically developed a text that was based on the Alexandrian text. They followed the Alexandrian text almost completely. It wasn't really eclectic. It was just following the Alexandrian text, which was, you know, Vaticanus, Sinaiticus, and all these. And they published that in 1881 and 1882, the New Testament in the original Greek. And their Greek critical text, became the foundation for the first true version. And when I say true, I mean the first one that was a popular version that was actually, you know, actually gained acceptance. There were translations before this. Scholars did none of them were printed widely or used widely. But the first major translation done beyond the King James was the English Revised Version, which was based on Westcott and Hort's revision of the Greek text. Okay? So, at the same time, there were two men in particular, and there was an outcry among some scholars, but for the most part, they followed Westcott and Hort. There were a few, most notably Burgeon and Scrivener, who defended the Textus Receptus. And these, by the way, were also great scholars. These were no fly-by-nighters. Okay, these Burgeon was Dean of Chichester. His book is still available, and it's still the... It's the one that all the King James only people talk about and quote. He's their great hero, Dean Burgeon. He was Dean of Chichester, John Burgeon. And he wrote a book called The Revised Revision, in which he really denigrated the Westcott-Hort text and defended the TR. He also wrote a book that defended the last nine verses of the Gospel of Mark. And so they kind of look at him as their hero. And Scrivener also defended the text, although he was not as prolific in terms of writing. Now, the reason I say all that is you have to understand that really up until 1881, the Textus Receptus was the accepted text of the Greek, basically in evangelicalism. And so, again, I'm looking at this from the perspective of those who would defend the King James. They would say something like this. You have a text that's basically from the 8th century to the 1881 that is fairly consistent and fairly, defined. There's not a lot of variation in it. And then all of a sudden, in 1881, the church decides, well, wait a minute. This isn't the true text. Let's go back to these three or four manuscripts, is basically what they do. It's really down to mainly just a small number of manuscripts, and they say, this is the correct text. And defenders of the TR said, well, no. You know, for 1,000 years, the church has been following this text. Why are we changing it now? Didn't these people know about this text? And that's kind of the discussion, okay? Now, understand that that's... I have a chart here at the bottom which I think describes pretty much where everyone is. It's a continuum. And that continuum explains what you have. You have, on the far left, you have the Westcott-Hort text, which basically takes the earliest manuscripts all the time. It's an Alexandrian text. And then you have, and this is probably where most evangelicals are today, you have the eclectic text, which basically says we'll take each variant and we will weigh each variant and we will weigh all the manuscript evidence at each variant so that they don't always follow the Alexandrian or Westcott-Hort text, but they usually do because they weigh those manuscripts as the most important because they're the earliest. So they follow those. Then you have... And this is something that's fairly new, actually. You have the majority text people. And this is probably most notably is, Zane Hodges in Dallas. Dallas Theological Seminary is kind of part of this, where they say, now, wait a minute, the majority text is of equal, or I should say of greater value than the... They basically follow what I was saying here, where they say, look, the majority text really is what we should weigh more heavily than the Alexandria text. That the majority text is actually a better text. And they, but they still follow the critical text idea. In other words, weighing each variant. But they give more weight to the majority text. And they say the majority text is the more reliable. I don't know of any translations done on the basis of that text, but they do have a text. I think they did in 1995. It's on my computer. It's on my Bible software. They have a majority text. You must understand, the Textus Receptus, while it reflects mainly the majority text, it does differ. In other words, there are verses like 1 John 5:7 that is not in the majority text, but it is in the Textus Receptus. Is this making sense? I don't want to be too technical here, but there are places where the Textus Receptus, that text that underlies the King James, differs from the majority text, that text type that basically is a reflection of all the texts. And so these people say, let's go by the majority text. They're still following a critical text. Then you have, on the right, you have more people who emphasize not a critical text, that is, of weighing all the variants and looking at all the, you know, weighing the manuscript evidence everywhere, but rather they emphasize the idea of preservation, the preservation of the text. That is, it's more of a theological position almost than a scientific position. And they say, generally, the Textus Receptus is the preserved text. It is the text that in God's providence was preserved. And so now, generally speaking, this is a continuum, so there's people all along this route here, but so a lot of people who would say the Textus Receptus is the preserved text would retain 1 John 5:7 based on the fact not that there's tons of manuscript evidence back here, but based on the fact that it's in the Textus Receptus. And that maybe there's things they know that we didn't know. And they just say basically the TR is the preserved text. I don't know, Ron, where does Peter fall in here? Because I know he likes the Textus Receptus, but I don't know where he... Do you know where he's at? He would say the TR is the preserved text? Would he say that? There is, by the way, one scholarly work that, again, was done in the middle 20th century that is actually very scholarly, that defends this position, and it's Hill. Edward Hills, I think, wrote a book called King James Version Defended. It is a scholarly, and even men of these other positions acknowledge that this is probably the most scholarly defense of the TR recently. And then there is, on the far right, those who say the King James Version is actually the preserved text. Now, that's not even a thinking position if you stop to think about this, but those who say that the King James Version in English is the actual preserved, God-preserved text. So they don't even talk about the TR, they don't even go back to Greek. And so these people would actually, you know, instead of looking at their Greek lexicon, they look up in their English dictionary. Why worry about the Greek? This is the preserved text. And so they would go so far as to say, and this is where it really becomes unthinking, they would go so far as to say, well, if you're going to go over to Italy and you're going to do a translation of the Bible, you don't translate the Greek, you translate the King James Version. You translate from English into Italian or whatever language. And so that's the far right. Those are generally the King James, what has become known as the King James only. And they will talk about the King James as if it is the Word of God, word for word, and that's actually becoming quite popular, especially in the South, I think, among Baptists. But generally speaking, you run into a real serious problem when you start arguing that way. I must admit, I have a leaning towards the idea of preservation. I realize there are problems with it, and I'm not an expert in this, so I just... My leaning is toward the idea of preservation. And the reason I say that is because, when I think about the fact that for 1,000 years, the text was pretty certain, and then all of a sudden in 1881, we decide it's not, that doesn't ring quite with me based on a few manuscripts. But I understand that that's the minority position. I also understand that the problem with preservation and thinking in terms of preservation is it becomes, you either have to go the whole way, because if you start, in other words, if you don't, if you say the TR is the preserved text, it's the preserved text, and you will never vary from it. So you could never say, well, 1 John 5:7 doesn't belong there because it's in the TR. In other words, there's no halfway position, really. You can't take preservation in a halfway kind of a way, if that makes sense to you. Am I? What's that? Well, there is a, I think in the 7th century, there is a text in a translation, not in a Greek version, but in a translation. There is a reference to it. There's only, I think, a total of like 3 or 4 manuscripts that have it in, and all the other ones are late, like 13th century or 14th century. It was Erasmus who put it in, knowing that there really wasn't good evidence for it. Again, I say all these things. Please remember, the text is, no matter which way you go, very certain. This is a small number of issues. This is one reason, and this is why the part of this comes out in my understanding of the two most critical passages in regard to textual criticism. John 8, not the whole chapter, John 7:53 to John 8:11, Mark, the last 9 verses of Mark. Those two sections, from a textual critical standpoint, probably don't belong. In other words, if you would simply weigh the evidence of the text, the textual evidence, you would say they don't belong, generally. And that is the opinion of most scholars today, even evangelical scholars. In most of your new versions, they're in brackets, meaning they probably don't belong here. I have a little of a hard time with that. My response is, but they've been in the church for 1,000 years. That's my leaning towards preservation. I know that but in the end, I treat them as the Word of God. If I were preaching through John, I'd preach through those verses as if they're the Word of God, because I do believe they belong there. I understand it's a minority position, but I lean towards the idea of preservation, which is one of the reasons I still like the King James, because I lean towards that idea of preservation. Again, I'm not dogmatic about that. I'm not pontificating here, because I realize the problems on both sides, but I must admit I lean towards that idea of preservation. Any questions to that point? Okay. Am I losing you? Is this okay? Now let me talk about a little bit about the history of English translation. And again, this is important in understanding how the history of the Bible in terms of within the English language. And I'll maybe give you a little English church history here to help make sense here. But the very first translation, full translation of the English Bible, was Wycliffe, John Wycliffe, 1384. Now, he's sometimes called the morning star of the Reformation, because while he was Roman Catholic, and he died a Roman Catholic, much of what he taught, and he was a brilliant man, he was an Oxford scholar, much of what he taught was really Reformation doctrine. He taught sola scriptura. That is, that the scriptures were the supreme authority. He taught against papacy. I mean, he was opposed to the papacy. He was opposed to indulgences. He came out towards the end of his life against transubstantiation, the idea that the mass becomes the actual blood and body of Christ, which of course is the heart of Catholicism. And it's amazing that he died a natural death. He had some protectors who kept him from being, but ordinarily a guy like Wycliffe would have been martyred. In fact, in 1428, after his death, few years after his death, they actually dug him up and burned his bones as a statement of their hatred of him. And he, by the way, had a major influence on John Huss, or as Gerhardt would say, John Hus, right? Hus? Hus? Yeah, he tells me Hus in Czech, that's German. I want to say Czechoslovakian, but that's not right. Is it? Yeah, in Czech. Hus means goose, right? It's John Hus. There were some students from Prague went to Oxford and came under the influence of Wycliffe, and they went back to Bohemia or Czechoslovakia, and they had an influence on John Hus. These two men were really the pre-reformers, and it's amazing that Martin Luther wasn't burned at the stake, but that was a whole political aspect of why he wasn't, and John Hus was. But at any rate, Wycliffe translated the whole New and Old Testament, notably, I should point out, not from the Greek, from Latin. This was from the Latin, and that was then revised by one of his helpers, John Purvey, or one of his followers. Now, understand that in Catholicism, they never encouraged, I guess that's putting it lightly, they never encouraged translating the Bible into the vernacular. Okay? That was never encouraged. Bible reading was never encouraged, really, until Vatican II here in 1960, whatever it was. So that they never encouraged it, although I don't think, looking at Wycliffe, that wasn't the main reason that he was, you know, dug up and burned. It was because of his other beliefs, okay? But understand, you can draw a line under Wycliffe, because when you start with Tyndale, it's a whole new scenario, okay? Every other translation on this page, from Tyndale down to the King James, the next page, all of them are founded on Tyndale, not Wycliffe. And part of the reason it's a whole new scenario or a whole new thing is because of the history of the Church of England. Okay, you understand, up until 1,000 years before this, for the 1,000 years before this, Roman Catholicism was the religion of England. Roman Catholicism had huge influence. The Pope had huge influence on the nation of England. Tyndale, if you notice his dates, 1492 to 1536, what happened in that period? America was discovered, right, Columbus. Henry VIII, which is the Reformation. The Reformation. Now understand, the Reformation, part of what came with the Reformation was the translation of the scriptures into the vernacular. Martin Luther was the first one, 1522, to translate it into German. But you must understand that translating the scriptures into the vernacular was a hallmark of the Reformation. And that's why it was so hated by the Roman Catholic Church. This was the spread of the Reformation. Now, the Reformation started in 1517 when Luther nailed his 95 Theses. And really, through the 1520s, the Reformation took hold and really became a revolution on the continent of Europe. In Germany and the Netherlands, that whole, really, the continent, there were pockets of Reformation. And, of course, it caused a huge stir and all kinds of problems and issues. But it was not in England. It did not go to England, although there were men there. But, I mean, it was strongly Roman Catholic. And Henry VIII, who was the ruler of England, was strongly Catholic. In fact, he became known as the defender of the faith because he attacked Luther in some writings defending the sacraments. Okay, so Henry VIII changed. There's a reason I'm giving you this history, because you have to understand what happened here with all these translations. You have to understand a little bit of the history of England. This is a very confusing period of history, but it's worth looking at. The Reformation did not come to England really until 1534. 1534.
And the reason it came was not because of religious reasons. It came because Henry VIII needed a divorce.
He married Catherine of Aragon, who was related to the throne in Spain, which is a very Catholic nation. And these two nations were allied. But Henry didn't have a son, and he needed an heir. And so he was trying for years, literally like 6 years, to get a divorce. And the Pope would not grant him a divorce because, well, Spain. Okay, this is political reasons. He wouldn't grant a divorce. And so he decided over a period of time, this took a few years, he decided he was going to make himself head of the church in England. And he was going to totally remove all influence of Catholicism from his country. Purely political reasons. He wanted a divorce. And so Thomas Cranmer, who became Archbishop of Canterbury, granted him the divorce. 1534 is notable because that was the year of the Act of Supremacy, where Parliament and the King made Henry VIII supreme head of the church, basically the Pope of the Church of England. And from that point, okay, it was technically reformed. It was technically took on the Reformation. But what you need to understand is that up until this point, it was very Catholic, and they were very much opposed to the idea of translation of Scripture. After this period, you understand, without getting into too much, Henry VIII could care less about the Reformation. He was still Catholic. Okay, all the principles of Catholicism he held on to. And so it's not as if all of a sudden in 1534 all the reformers were welcome to come to England. Really, doctrine didn't change much in the Church of England, with the exception of a little. There was some, you know, Thomas Cranmer had some influence towards the Reformation, but generally Henry VIII was not like a total liberal trying to totally change the church into Reformation principles. He just wanted a divorce, which he got. Now, Tyndale printed his Bible before this. He printed his Bible, if you notice there, in 1526, 1530, and 1531 sections of it. And now why Tyndale is so significant is, first of all, because he printed, it was the first printed edition of any English Bible. Wycliffe's was not printed. It was before Gutenberg. This was the first printed edition, but even more significant, Tyndale and his work was really the foundation for all these other translations. He worked from the Hebrew and the Greek, unlike Wycliffe, who did it in the Latin. He was a true Greek and Hebrew scholar, and he was excellent at translating into English idiom. And he had a major effect on what came to be the King James Version. But all these versions are in some way, shape, or form, all these translations are built on Tyndale, and really, in essence, revisions of Tyndale. But he died at the stake, or he was burned at the stake in 1536. He did all this printing in Europe, on the continent. He had to flee England because they were very much opposed to printing of Bibles, so he went to, I think, Holland, where he did most of his printing, and he was eventually arrested and caught. He did all this in secret, and he was arrested, burned at the stake, and he's famous for the words, "Lord, open the King of England's eyes," which he said before he was burned at the stake. That's Tyndale, very interesting person. After him came Miles Coverdale, and Miles Coverdale, because he was printing Bibles in the vernacular. You understand that it was equivalent to, he was a reformer. Tyndale was a reformer, took on reform principles, or the Reformation principles. He was burnt at the stake by the Catholics because he was printing Bibles in the vernacular. You understand that to print Bibles in the vernacular meant Reformation. It was the spread of the Reformation. And, you know, that was Tyndale's purpose. You know, he wanted to, in his words, put the Bible in the hand of every plowboy. And of course, this is very much opposed to Catholic you know, the whole Catholic. And the other thing was Tyndale's notes. You know, he had, it wasn't the MacArthur Study Bible, but he had notes. And those notes were very much, you know, based on the Reformation. I mean, they were opposed to Catholicism, which is part of the issue. But that's, he was burned at the stake by the Catholics. His helper or assistant, Miles Coverdale, after his death, completed the first complete printed English Bible. Tyndale's was not complete. He didn't have time to finish it. He was working on the prophets and Proverbs and Psalms when he was in prison, but he didn't finish it. It was Coverdale who printed the first complete edition of the English Scriptures. And he had several editions of that. But now notice, this was done 1535. Okay, this was done after this. And these actually, the next couple were actually condoned by the church in England. John Rogers, who was also an assistant of William Tyndale, printed what's called the Matthew's Bible. And he used it, Thomas Matthew, as a pen name, so it became known as the Matthew's Bible, 1537. John Rogers basically took Tyndale's work and Coverdale's work and combined them. He used them and made another. So you see, all these are based on Tyndale's. But John Rogers was the first Protestant martyr. What happened was, after Henry Rainsill, I have this down here somewhere, 1547, Henry VIII died in 1547. And after him, Edward VI reigned. But Edward VI, who was very young and sickly, died in just a few years. He reigned until 1553. 1547 to 1553, he was the son of Jane Seymour, which is the third wife of Henry VIII. At any rate, under Edward is when the Reformation really took hold in England. And it's when Hugh Latimer, John Rogers, Ridley, all these men who are well known in the Reformation of England, were reforming England truly according to Reformation principles after the death of Henry VIII and during the reign of Edward. However, Edward died very soon, and Catherine of Aragon's daughter, Mary Tudor, took the throne, who was very, very Catholic. And she reversed the whole thing. And she became known as Bloody Mary because she put all these men to death. The first one she put to death was John Rogers. But all these men, Hugh Latimer, Ridley, these guys all were burned at the stake when the Reformation was reversed under Mary. After Mary's reign, which lasted only 5 years until 1558, then Queen Elizabeth I reigned. And she, for political reasons, adopted the Reformation. And it was under Elizabeth I then that really the Reformation grew, and then you had the whole thing of Puritans, and we can talk about that. The point is this. John Rogers, when he printed his Bible, it was actually approved by the government or the Church of England, but then later in his life he was actually put to death because he was a Protestant. Then in 1539 there was the Great Bible, which was done under the direction of Coverdale, and it was called the Great Bible because it was so large, but it was authorized for use in the churches, the Church of England. The Church of England needed a translation that would be acceptable for the Church of England, and so they did this Great Bible, which was a revision of the Matthew's Bible. So all this is based, again, it's a revision of a revision. And then one of the more significant ones is the Geneva Bible. This was produced by Protestant exiles who went to Geneva. They fled England during the reign of Mary, under the reign of Bloody Mary. They fled England and they went to Geneva, which is where Calvin was. And they produced an English translation there at Geneva, which was translated from the original languages. Up to this point, it was the best translation they had. It was a good translation. I have a page of it in my office, an original. I'm not sure what year it was, but at any rate, this is the Bible of the Puritans. It's the Bible of Shakespeare. and it went through at least 140 editions. It was a very popular Bible in the homes of the English people. It was not acceptable to the Church of England because it was too radical. It was too Reformation-oriented. It was full of, again, it was full of notes and things that were pro-Reformation. And so it was not really accepted within the Church of England, but it was the church, it was the Bible that everyone used in their homes. It was the first English Bible to divide all of the Bible into verses, and it was the first one to use italicized words to indicate where they had added English words to make the original clear, which they still do in most versions except for the NIV. Then on page 45, we have the Bishop's Bible. The Bishop's Bible was done by the Church of England in response to the Geneva Bible. The Geneva Bible was very popular. It was known to be a good scholarly work. It was known to be better, of better quality than what was being used in the churches at that time, which was the Great Bible. And so they felt like they had to do another version that would be more acceptable for the Church of England, that would be that would gain acceptance. So they did the Great Bible, or the Bishop's Bible. And it was called the Bishop's Bible because it was some bishops that did it. And this was what was generally found in churches until the King James Version was done. So, and then came the King James Version. And basically, yes?
Was it a different translation or just got different notes?
No, it was a different translation. They did a different translation. Yes. Oh, really? I'm sorry. No, I haven't. Not that I'm aware of. I'm not sure. No, that would be news to me. Yeah, I don't know. The King James Version was kind of a call on the part of the Puritans, and by the way, the Puritans in a nutshell were people who were in the Church of England who wanted to reform it according to Reformation principles. That's really bottom line. Puritans were people who wanted to take the Church of England, which was very Catholic when this whole thing started. They wanted to reform it. They wanted to get rid of all this liturgy and all this, this really the high church kind of stuff. And they wanted the Reformation principles. And of course, there were various levels of Puritans. There were those who actually left. They were called separatists. You had independents, you had Presbyterians, you had all these. But they're all kind of grouped as Puritans. But they were people who wanted to purify the Church of England. Okay. Well, these Puritans, when King James I came to the throne, handed him what's called the Millenary Petition, because it had 1,000 names on it. And they wanted some reform. In response to this, King James called the Hampton Court Conference, and it was suggested by one John Reynolds, who was a Puritan from Oxford. It was suggested by him that they do a translation. And the idea was that they wanted a translation that could be used both in the churches and in the homes, because they still had this duality of you had the Bishop's Bible for the church and you had the Geneva Bible. They wanted one that would supersede both, and which it did. It was very successful. It was the work of 47 translators. It was technically a revision of the Bishop's Bible, but they did go back to the original languages. They referred to other versions with other languages. But probably what made it most acceptable, besides its quality, was the absence of theological notes. They had textual notes, but they had no theological notes. So that it made it acceptable to both parties, both those in the Church of England who were more Catholic and those who were more Puritans or more reform-minded. They left out all the theology notes so that it was acceptable to both. Geisler and Nix, who's no lover of the King James, gives these five reasons why the King James was so successful, and it was. It was the version until really the ASV and the ESV and so forth, or the ASV and the RV. But at any rate, These are the five things he listed. Number one, the qualifications and piety of the translators. They were the best that were available. And by the way, if you're familiar at all with that period of church history in England, you know that there were some truly godly men in England in this time period, and these men were great scholars. This was really kind of from the standpoint of scholarship and piety, we would probably look back in this period of English church history as a good period. There were some really truly great men in that period. The universal sense that it was a national effort supported by the king. It had the wholehearted support of the king. It had the wholehearted support of the church and of the Puritans. It was the accumulated effort of nearly a century of work beginning with Tyndale, so that you had this accumulation of work behind it. And then the literary atmosphere of the period, which was very high as well. And then the religious climate of the day, which is what I was kind of talking about a moment ago, and that it was truly theology and religion was at the center of society in that time period. So that this version became very well liked and very popular, and it became really the only version for all intents and purposes until, again, we get into the very early 20th century. Any questions? Well, yes and no. I mean, even Tyndale's work was based on Erasmus's work. So that all of these are basically based on the same Greek text. Maybe not exactly, but basically. The variations between the different Greek texts here are small. So generally it's based on the same Greek text as the other ones were. To answer your question, I mean, if you say technically, you know, the Textus Receptus is the 1598 edition of Baeza's, at least according to this book. If that's true, they certainly used that in the King James Version. So I guess, but I wouldn't say it was the first one, because really all of these are based on the same basic text. The Vulgate goes back to Jerome, which is like 4th century, 5th century. What Jerome is, 4th century. Yes. As of Council of Trent, it was official. No. No, in fact, up until, I have this on the next page. Up until 1943, all Catholic translations were from the Latin. The Vulgate in Council of Trent, 40 whatever, the Council of Trent, the Vulgate was pronounced the official scriptures of the Catholic Church, so that all translations were done. And again, the Catholic Church was not promoting translation into the vernacular, but all their study was from the Latin.